I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and this is Up to Date. We all know how the Civil War ended, but in 1862, when Abraham Lincoln was trying to glue together pieces of a fractured nation, victory was no foregone conclusion. This hour, we'll visit with Time magazine writer and Kansas Cityan David Vondrely about his new book on 1862. It chronicles Lincoln's struggle to unite governmental and military leadership, overcome a drooping economy, and manage the bloodiest war the nation had ever seen. We'll also discuss how Lincoln's strategies and results apply to today and the upcoming election. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Up to date. I'm Steve Kraske. In one way, the year 1862 was just another 12 months on the calendar, but a new book, Rise to Greatness, Abraham Lincoln and America's Most Perilous Year, argues that it was the most important year in American history. 1862 began with the nation on the brink. The federal government was overwhelmed, the country was out of money, and the North's top general was gravely ill. The Confederacy, meantime, had a commanding position on the battlefield and a booming economy. But 12 months later, the tide had turned, and the man doing much of the turning was Abraham Lincoln. Kansas City's David Vondrely is the author of Rise to Greatness, Abraham Lincoln and America's Most Perilous Year. He is an editor-at-large at Time magazine and the author of three previous books. He joins us this morning from NPR Studios in Washington. And David, so good to have you. Good morning.
It's great to be with you, Steve. I wish I was there right across the table.
Still can't get a flight out, eh?
Quite a storm.
I know it was. I know it was. Well, one of the things that surprised me most about this book was just how dire the situation was for the country at the beginning of 1862. You know, I mean, bleak isn't putting it too strongly. David, set the scene for us at the beginning of 1862. Just where was the country at that point?
Steve, the banks in the North had just announced that they were no longer going to redeem U.S. currency with precious metals. They basically closed their exchange windows. Across the ocean, the Prime Minister of Britain, Lord Palmerston, announced to his foreign ministry that he thought there was no chance that the North could subdue the South. George McClellan, the general of the armies, was unwilling to tell Abraham Lincoln any of his plans for how he was going to attack the rebellion, and now he was near death with typhoid fever. The Congress had appointed an oversight committee to find out what was going on and had just, on New Year's Eve, had a long meeting with Lincoln, at which it became clear to the congressman and to the cabinet that Lincoln really had no idea what was going on. So meanwhile, there were rumors swirling through Washington of a military coup. There was open talk even among loyal Republicans about the need for a military dictatorship. No republic of elected leaders had ever survived anything like the crisis of the Civil War, and very few people thought it was possible. And so that was the hand that Abraham Lincoln was playing when he woke up on New Year's Day, 1862.
Well, it was so interesting to me just how little confidence so many folks had in the president of the United States, who would one day be enshrined on the Mall in Washington, D.C. Edward Bates, no less a personage than Abraham Lincoln's attorney general, described Lincoln as rudderless. Why did he say that?
Well, it was after this shocking meeting on New Year's Eve, and Bates hadn't realized, you know, really how completely McClellan had frozen Lincoln out of his plans. And he said, you know, Lincoln is a good man. He seems honest, in the main wise, he says, but I fear that he lacks the power to command. And this was the feeling that Lincoln's friends and supporters had, was that he's a nice guy, but he's out of his depth. You can imagine what his critics were saying.
You know, you begin this book with this look at the president on New Year's Day in 1862, and there were various people observing that scene. An artist was making renderings of what he was observing. Describe for us what people saw as they came into, I think it was the Blue Room, of the White House. What did they see when they came in to greet the president on this New Year's Day, 1862?
Well, back in those days, Steve, it was the tradition to open the White House to all comers each New Year's Day. And so this was the first chance that many people had to lay eyes on this strange figure from the West who was now the president. And when they walked in, they saw a striking physical specimen. He was almost 6 feet four, about 180 pounds of absolute solid muscle. We noticed how skinny he was, but it was all sinew. He loved to do feats of strength to show younger men how much stronger he was than they were. But he had unnaturally long arms and legs, short torso. He had huge hands and feet. His critics nicknamed him the gorilla. And this really captures the kind of shambling animal force he had about him. Many women found him strangely attractive. Many men found him both charismatic and sort of repulsive. When he would open his mouth to talk, this giant figure would let out this incongruously high and reedy voice with a twang from Kentucky, where he was born and spent his first years. McClellan, who grew up the son of a prominent Philadelphia doctor and had impeccable manners and good grace, it was just appalled by Lincoln because he would laugh about how he didn't carry a handkerchief around. You know, he would put his feet up on the furniture. And yet, as the year would go by, people, little by little, it began to dawn on him that there was something really remarkably powerful about this man.
And that did begin to dawn on them as the year unfolds here, right?
They
begin to see a different man. Before you go there, David, you tell this little story. I think McClellan tells this story about the handkerchief, and the president is asked at one point to produce one. Describe that moment for us and how McClellan responded to it and what the president of the country said when he didn't have one.
Yeah, well, it was this neat event shortly before the start of 1862. They had a famous magician come to the White House and put on his show for a crowd of elites, and he was a sleight-of-hand artist. And at one point, he's going to make something disappear under a handkerchief, and he asks the president for his handkerchief, and Lincoln snorts and says, "I ain't got any." And McClellan is appalled.
Yes.
So uncouth and unmannerly.
We're visiting with Kansas City's David von Drehle. He's an editor-at-large for Time magazine about his new book, Rise to Greatness, Abraham Lincoln and America's Most Perilous Year. And you can see and hear David von Drehle as he talks about his book next Tuesday, November 13th, a week from Tuesday, at 7 o'clock at Unity Temple on the Plaza. You can call Rainy Day Books in Fairway at 913-384-3126 for more details. You know, one of the themes, David, that you convey so well in this book is a sense of just how much Abraham Lincoln had on his plate at any given moment. There was the matter of the war, of course, and there was the small matter of running the country. But one of his big challenges was managing his family, which includes two still young boys and a wife who could be exceedingly difficult. Tell us a little more about what he faced on the home front back in those days.
Well, at the start of the year, Mary, his wife, who was, she was living proof that opposites attract. She was everything that Lincoln wasn't, starting physically, of course. She was short and plump. He was tall and skinny. She was mercurial. He was very melancholy, phlegmatic. Mm-hmm. She was unpredictable, flighty, insecure. He was disciplined and very secure in his own talents and skills. But what they shared was a tremendous ambition and a tremendous interest in politics. They were both very politically astute. Mary, though, when she got to Washington, her insecurities caused her to want to show that she was every bit as elegant and refined as these fine women of Eastern society. And so she began spending money. Money that the government didn't have, money that she and her husband didn't have. And she got into all sorts of schemes that basically amounted to embezzlement. She became very susceptible to flattering spies, really. And all of this was unraveling just as the year was beginning. The Congress was beginning to understand that she had overspent accounts dramatically, and also that a rogue figure who called himself the Chevalier Wyckoff had flattered his way into her inner circle and had stolen the president's annual address and leaked it to a Democratic newspaper in New York.
Yeah. So he's not getting any support in some ways from his wife then, who's just sort of off on her own.
She's not making matters any easier for him.
And meantime, his sons are running literally all over the White House. They're just a little bit wild, a little bit out there, right? And what would the president do when they did that?
Lincoln was very lax. Parent. He was very loving. His philosophy, as he expressed it, was that love was the chain by which to bind your children to you. It was the opposite of his own upbringing. His father was remote, emotionally remote and harsh. And Lincoln left him behind as soon as he was able to. But the boys, Tad and Willie, were the first young kids really ever to live in the White House, and they had the run of the place, and they had two friends who lived around the block who would come over, the Taft boys, Bud and Holly, and the four of these boys would go stampeding through the house. They would rewire the bells that were used to summon servants so that they'd ring all through the house.
Yeah.
They'd put on, you know, plays and musicales in the attic and sell tickets to the people who were waiting out in the line to see Lincoln, and even tickets to Lincoln, and everybody would have to troop up to the attic and see, you know, Willie in a dress singing, you know, some show tune. And they built a, one day they turned the roof of the White House into a ship and stood up there with a borrowed spyglass looking for rebels on the opposite shore of the Potomac and running downstairs, interrupting cabinet meetings to report on their findings. They were
just like it happens today,
right? Yeah, you can't study it without falling in love with those boys.
Yeah. Well, and if that wasn't enough chaos, David, the president's office was smack in the midst of the family's very snug quarters in the White House. Describe to us just how crowded things were for the president and where he actually did his work.
Yeah, this was before the West Wing had been built. So the president's office was on the second floor of the White House along with the residential quarters. And there's and really anybody who wanted to was welcome to come in, you know, say hello to the doorman and walk upstairs to try to get a minute or two with the president and plead for a job or for, you know, some kind of relief from the federal government. You know, the presidency was such a small office in a sense when Lincoln came in. The entire executive staff for which he had a budget was one person. Mm-hmm. The president was allowed to hire one secretary. He had to hide his second secretary, John Hay, on another department's budget at the beginning of the term. And yet virtually overnight, the federal government was being transformed into this colossus with millions of employees and troops. The federal budget grew by 600% in the year 1862. And so all of this was having to happen, you know, on the fly. He was having to appoint thousands of people to federal jobs. And all these folks would line up in the hallway and wait for Lincoln. Meanwhile, in the household, he had in-laws showing up and staying for months at a time. He had his own sons and children. He had so there was no place really for Lincoln to go to escape from the craziness. He would. As a result, he had this knack for just sort of lapsing into the catatonic states. People would look over at him, and he'd suddenly be staring off into space as if he had gone completely blank. But that's when he got his thinking done. He also was a terrible insomniac during the war, slept very little. It says a lot about that haggard look that we all know from the last years of the war. But he would say, that's when I can get my thinking done, when everyone else is asleep.
Again, we're visiting with Kansas City's David Von Draley about his new book on Abraham Lincoln in the year 1862. That book is titled Rise to Greatness, Abraham Lincoln and America's Most Perilous Year. You know, this is sort of we've been describing the upside, the family side, the more joyous side to the president's life. And yet, death is all around this president as this year unfolds. In February, his son Willie, the son who most resembled the president, became gravely ill. And life for Abraham Lincoln very much came to a halt then. How did Willie resemble his father, David?
Willie was, physically, he looked like a Todd, his mother's side, which meant that he was dashing and handsome. Hmm. But emotionally and intellectually, he was very like his father. He was deeply thoughtful, well-read for an 11-year-old boy. He wrote poetry. He was interested in politics and current events. He was utterly charming. There's this scene that I find captivating of Willie and Tad out on the front lawn playing when Secretary of State Seward pulls up to the White House with the Crown Prince of France in the carriage with him. And without even thinking, Willie stands up and straightens his back, takes off his cap and gives a low bow to the prince, and then turns around and goes back to what he was doing. It was that kind of kid.
Wow.
Adults loved him, and at the same time, you know, kids liked him as well. Except for his younger brother, who was the opposite. Tad was always getting into trouble and had a learning disability. And there's this scene where Tad is in church and somehow manages to cut his finger with a pocket knife in the middle of the sermon. And the babysitter, Julia Taft, scolds him under her breath. And he says, "You just look over at Willie sitting there good as pie."
You know, he was a good one.
Hard for Tad to be the red-haired stepchild.
And so the president is closest to Willie.
The president would, one friend said, he was fonder of that boy than of anything else in the world. He would look over at Willie deep in thought, and he'd say, "I know exactly what's going on in that boy's head, because the way he solves problems, the same way I do."
When he became ill, David, he became ill with what?
Typhoid fever, which is spread through contaminated drinking water, contaminated by human waste. The area around Washington, D.C. Had filled up in a space of a few months with over 100,000 troops in camps on the hillsides around here, basically unsanitary camps that the men set up themselves. And the whole watershed was quickly polluted. And, you know, the White House had running water at that time, but the running water was drawn straight out of the Potomac River. And typhoid, there was an epidemic of typhoid. There was an epidemic of epidemics in Washington. There was smallpox, there was measles, there was typhoid. People were dying left and right long before they ever got to the battlefield.
So he becomes ill. How does Mary Lincoln handle all this?
Well, the president's grief was tremendous, but his life had been saturated in grief. You know, his mother, who he deeply loved, died when he was 9 years old, and then his older sister, who was the person he was closest to in the world, died when he was a teenager. If you believe some of the legends, his true love in life, Anne Rutledge, died before they could be married. And now here was his favorite son dying, and Lincoln kept a vigil by his bedside. But he couldn't fall apart. You know, Mary could, and she did. When Willie died, she had a complete nervous breakdown. And what that did was make Lincoln's life even harder, because she abandoned Tad, who was also sick. She forbade the boys' friends, the Taft boys, from ever coming in the White House again because it made her too sad to see them. Tad now, at age 9, was completely left alone without a friend. And Lincoln had to be his friend. So there are these very touching stories about Tad, running until he dropped on the floor in front of the fireplace in Lincoln's office, and Lincoln, at the end of a long day, picking him up and carrying him up to bed. Tad was so frightened by Willie's death that for many months he insisted on sleeping in Lincoln's bed. So all this was going on while Lincoln was trying to save the country.
You know, David, there's a very touching moment in here in your book when Lincoln asks for a nurse to help his family deal with the loss of his son. And the nurse that comes to the White House, her name is Rebecca Pomeroy, and she had been volunteering at one of Washington's largest military hospitals. She and the president have a conversation. Tell us about that and what he asked her at that point.
Well, she showed up at a time when Mary was, had collapsed into bed, screaming and moaning, and Tad was still recuperating from his own bout of typhoid, and Lincoln was at wit's end. He walked in to the room where she was sitting by Tad's bed and began to ask her about herself, and quickly found that she was in Washington because she had lost most of her family to illness, and that her last of her sons was off in fighting in the army. And Lincoln asked her, apparently she radiated a sense of peace, and he asked her, how can you achieve this? And she explained her religious conversion. And they talked over and over again about her faith in God and his difficulty in getting to that point. You know, he had lost another son, Edward, years before, and had spent a lot of time in conversation with a family pastor then. And yet he was a man who had grown up as a definite religious skeptic. And so he was wrestling with the meaning of his son's life, with the meaning of life in general, with the meaning of this increasingly terrible war. The role of what he called divine will or providence in all that was going on was a topic very much on his mind all through this year.
And as you point out, you wonder how he's managing all of this and at the same time trying to save the country. It's just really overwhelming.
Stamina. The seed for this book, Steve, was years ago when I was reading the Pulitzer Prize winning biography of Lincoln by David Herbert Donald.
Yeah.
I got to the end of his account of 1862, and I thought, how could anyone have survived that? Just the sheer emotional and mental strain of it. The idea that anyone could get through it, let alone, as I found when I dug deeper and began putting the book together, not just survive it, but master the situation. I think it's one of the great achievements of human will and human intellect in all of history, really.
Well, let's take a break, David. When we come back, we'll continue our very good conversation here with Time Magazine's David Vondrelli. His new book, again, is titled Rise to Greatness, Abraham Lincoln and America's Most Perilous Year. You can see and hear David Tuesday, November 13th at Unity Temple on the Plaza. That's a Tuesday night. Call Rainy Day Books in Fairway at 913-384-3126 for more details. When we come back, we'll talk a little bit more about how David pulled this book together amidst a sea of research and information on Abraham Lincoln. And we'll talk about how he dealt with the pressures, how the president dealt with all these pressures a little bit more, too. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. We're back. I'm Steve Kraske. If you missed yesterday's debate with political strategists Roy Temple and Jeff Rowe, you can find it in all of our previous broadcasts at kcur.org. On tomorrow's program, we'll discuss political cartoons and how they affect the presidency, and Brian McTavish returns with our weekend to-do list. This hour, we're visiting with David Vondrelli about his new book about Abraham Lincoln and the year 1862. If you want to join our conversation, 816-235-2888 is our phone number. Up to date at kcur.org is our email address. You can also go to KCUR's Facebook page or tweet us at KCUR Up to Date. David, why did you decide to write a book about a war and a president, both of which have been the subject of so many books? You mentioned the seed of this book, but why did you decide to weigh into some very heavy waters here?
Well, at first, the amount that's been written about Lincoln and the war, it was immensely intimidating. But I realized that this was a subject that had fascinated me since I was a boy. Mm-hmm. And in fact, the reason that all those books have been written is because it's fascinating to so many Americans. This is our most dramatic and in many ways our most important story. And I also came to feel that there was a pretty widespread, what I believe is a misunderstanding of the course of the war, that because the North eventually became immensely more powerful in terms of industrial might and manpower than the South, that it was always the North's advantage over the South. And that wasn't true. At the beginning, as I say, knowledgeable observers thought that it was inevitable that the South would win. Moreover, I think there's a misunderstanding about the year 1862, because Lincoln did go through so much struggle to find the right moment to replace George McClellan at the head of the army, mm-hmm. and the right moment to issue the Emancipation Proclamation. Many people tend to look at this year as one of failure, as Lincoln's darkest year. The more I studied it, the more convinced I was that this was really the year that Lincoln saved the Union. While there was much drama and terrible amount of bloodshed after 1862, really the die was cast. 1862 was the Confederacy's best chance to win its independence, and instead it suffered the defeats that ultimately led to its defeat. And I felt that was a story that needed to be brought into sharper definition.
If you have an opinion about where Lincoln ranks as among our greatest presidents, our phone number here, 816-235-2888, and our email address, updatedate@kcur.org. Well, how do you approach a topic like this, given the overwhelming amount of material that's available to you? I mean, how many books do you read? Where do you go to find new and original ideas on turf that's been trod over so many times?
Well, the huge volume of books, in a way, is liberating because you realize that you can't read it all. And so what I did, my first goal was to try to give a sense of what it was like to be Abraham Lincoln through this incredibly dramatic trial. The Lincoln presidency and Lincoln's personality are both so complex that most writers either have to summarize very quickly in order to get the whole picture in, or they have to take one slice. So you get books like Lincoln and His Generals. You get books like Lincoln and the Emancipation Proclamation, Lincoln and Slavery, Lincoln and His Family.
Right.
What I tried to do was, by focusing on 1 year, be able to give all those slices and show how all these things were happening at the same time, so that Lincoln will walk out of a meeting with generals and suddenly receive news of a problem in his foreign policy overseas, or he'll have a terrible session with Mary right before he hears about an equally terrible, you know, or dramatic battle somewhere out in the country. And so by layering these chronologically through the course of a year, I think you get a better sense of how all these pieces fit together, of the juggling act that he had to do, of his political genius, which really was the core of his success, and a better sense of I hope, of him as a man.
I mean, how do you manage as a writer, as a researcher, to avoid becoming overwhelmed yourself, again, when you take on a topic this broad and this deep?
Well, I was overwhelmed for a number of years. This project turned out to be much bigger and more difficult than anything I had attempted before as a writer. Ultimately, I read and read and read. And then I made an index card for every day of the year. And the beauty of Lincoln is that his life is so well studied, so well documented, that you have books like the wonderful Lincoln Day by Day, which in three volumes sets out everything that's known about Lincoln and what he did each day. Have his everything he wrote collected in the or that we know of that he wrote. Collected in the collected works, and you have the Civil War day by day, and then there are diaries. There were lots of people who knew they were living through something incredible and kept diaries at least sporadically. So I would layer these on, sort of like sheets of acetate, one on top of another, and these index cards would gradually show me the way through a month. And I knew I was never able to see the whole thing in my head at once from start to finish, but I would sort of get myself from the start of the month to the end of the month and then pick up a new pack of index cards.
It makes me nervous just hearing you describe it, taking on something this vast. You know, did you feel pressure to come up with something new? Or at this point, is it really possible to come up with much new on a president like Abraham Lincoln and a period like the Civil War?
I tried to find a few new things, and I did find one or two little slivers. There's a among Civil War buffs, there's a kind of a famous scene recorded in one of the diaries in which Edwin Stanton runs into Lincoln's office and he says, "I have a letter in my hand from one of the greatest men in the North saying that, explaining that McClellan is really a traitor." But he says, "I can't tell you who it's from." And I did figure out who it was from a former Secretary of the Treasury, Thomas Ewing. I found that in the Ewing family papers at the Library of Congress. But more to the point, the great historian Eric Foner, whose book, The Fiery Trial, about Lincoln and slavery, won every conceivable prize last year, a magnificent book, said recently in an interview, "You know, we're never going to find a trunk of forgotten Lincoln papers in somebody's attic. You know, we basically know what we know, but that doesn't mean that we are not still wrestling with exactly what it means."
You decided. Yeah, go ahead.
And it has fresh meanings for each new generation. It really does. Mm-hmm.
You decided to divide this book by months. Was that just the convenient thing to do to just make sense, David, or why that approach?
Well, it applied a discipline of chronology and kept me from going off on too many flights. It lent some order to what seems to be, on first glance, a pretty chaotic tale. So it was a structural discipline, but I was surprised when I got into it how the story did kind of move month by month, how many, you know, battles were fought near the end of a month, or how many, and how each month seemed to have its own character and its own mood to it. That was a surprise to me, I would say, compared to you know, what I thought was just a way of structuring it.
David von Vreeli is our guest. His new book, Rise to Greatness, Abraham Lincoln and America's Most Perilous Year. He lives in Kansas City. He's an editor-at-large for Time magazine. And in Time, David, you just wrote a bit about what contemporary presidents, contemporary leaders might learn from what Lincoln went through and endured 150 years ago. What are the lessons that you glean from Lincoln's experiences back in those days?
Well, any president would benefit from a whole seminar on Lincoln, but a couple of ideas that jumped out at me. First off, Lincoln had the hide of a rhinoceros. You could not say anything that would offend him. And
a lot of
result,
things were said to him that were very offensive, right? He endured a lot of
far,
that stuff.
Far worse than anything that's said about politicians today. And, you know, it's a misnomer, or it's a mistake to think that there was not a critical, you know, vicious sort of blogosphere-like press at the time. There were a tremendous number of newspapers and of every political slant. And Lincoln was constantly worried about how they would take his every word and twist it to their own agendas. But he had this ability to forgive past slights if he needed to use somebody. If a person could be useful to him, it didn't matter to him what that person had said or done to him in the past. He held no grudges. His favorite remark, according to his secretary, John Hay, was, "I'm in favor of short statutes of limitations in politics. If a man ceases to attack me, I will not hold a grudge against him." And this allowed him to draw not just his friends and supporters into his administration, but to draw his political opponents into his administration and make use of him. And that was an important part of holding the Union coalition together. The second thing,
and it sort of gives rise to the whole team of rivals idea,
exactly,
in his cabinet,
exactly.
Right? Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, Salmon Chase, his Treasury Secretary, was pretty openly campaigning against him for the next nomination through this entire year. And people would come and say, do you know what Chase is up to? And Lincoln would say, of course I know what he's up to, but he makes a good secretary, and as long as he does that, I don't care.
And that's remarkable in and of itself, right?
It is. It is. But Lincoln had this enormous self-confidence. You know, there are some biographers who suggest he had an insecurity. Yeah, I don't see it at all. His secretaries would read critical newspaper editorials to him at various times, and he'd say, you know, he'd wave it away and say, I know more about that than they do. It just didn't bother him. He had enormous patience. He had a great sense of the political public mood, and was very sensitive to it. And then most of all, and I think this is most applicable to the times that we live in, which are divisive, polarized times, but certainly no more than Lincoln lived through. Lincoln understood that the road to success in American politics is down the middle, that the center is the key to getting done what he needed to do. He described himself, compared himself to a tightrope walker crossing Niagara Falls. and having to keep his balance between the right and the left. And that was uppermost to him. He always said, if I can hold the Union together, if I can keep the North together long enough, we will win. And the last thing I would say is that Lincoln understood why he wanted to win. He wanted to win because he knew that the United States, the idea of the American experiment, was something special in world history. He understood this because he had lived it himself. He was born in a hovel. As a baby, newborn baby, he was wrapped in animal skins and laid on a dirt floor. And from that point, he had been able to lift himself up by his own efforts to the highest office in the land. And he knew there was nowhere else in the world at that time or at any time in history where that could be possible. And this was what was in danger of being destroyed by the rebellion, and he was not going to let that happen. And so he had this vision on the future that was possible, the prosperity that America could achieve. In his last annual message at the end of 1862, he painted this picture that is stunning in its accuracy, in which he talks about, you know, someday, in a generation or two, the United States is going to be richer than all the nations of Europe put together. Well, guess what? It came true. He was that far-seeing. And he was able to paint this picture for people, hold them together, and you know, gird them for this horrible ordeal that they would have to go through to get there.
Again, we're visiting with David von Dreyle about his new book about Abraham Lincoln in the year 1862. You know, this notion, David, of keeping the Union together, you write about this. He's constantly juggling this pressure to end slavery, which he's known so well for, with this pressure to keep certain border states. I'm thinking about Missouri. I'm thinking about Kentucky inside the Union fold as the war proceeds. How does he pull that off, this juggling act, which is a constant pressure for him throughout 1862?
Yeah, one of the things I had to learn and understand to get this book done was simple geography. You know, airplanes and interstate highways have sort of allowed us to conquer our understanding of geography. But back in those days, geography was destiny. And if you wanted to get from one place to another in the old United States, you had to do it by rivers. Well, Missouri and Kentucky controlled the rivers in the heartland of America, and he had to hold on to those two states, which were slave-owning states. He did it in a couple of ways. He took a very step-by-step approach to slavery. He started by proposing a gradual process of compensated emancipation where people would be paid to free their slaves over a period of years. Very, you know, modest and reasonable centrist approach to the problem. And he let the people in the border states think about that and ultimately reject it, so that it wasn't he who had passed up that opportunity, but they had. He also drove the war south at every opportunity to get the rebels as far away from those border states as he could do. Didn't work necessarily well in the East, where we often focus, but in the West, it worked brilliantly, thanks to a young store clerk from Illinois, a failure in life, named Ulysses S. Grant, who sort of got the green light from Lincoln and ran with it. And his early successes are really overlooked in terms of their importance to winning the war. Grant, in a couple of weeks in February of 1862, probably accomplished more with fewer men than any general at any other time in the war.
Let's go to some phone calls. I've been neglected to go grab them here. 816-235-2888 is our phone number, our email address, up-to-date at kcur.org. Let's go to John from Lawrence. John, welcome to the show.
Hello.
Hi.
Hello, Steve. Hello, David. Yeah,
hi.
I just had a couple of questions, and the first one you may not be able to answer since your focus is on 1862.
Don't sell David von Dreyle short, John.
I'll try not to. Well, I was curious about the alleged duel between Abraham Lincoln and James Shields in 1842, whether or not you knew if there was any sort of credibility to that or not. There's a lot of conjecture about it on the internet. The other question I had was regarding Abraham Lincoln's sentiment towards black people and slavery. There's a lot of quotes, perhaps misquotes, about Abraham Lincoln and how he felt in regard to slavery. He's often quoted as saying, you know, his reason for freeing the slaves was so that the slaves could be sent back to Africa and that they shouldn't intermingle with the white people. So I was wondering if there was any truth to that. I'll take my answers off the air.
John, thank you. David, begin with the whole duel question that John asked about back in 1842.
Well, James Shields and Lincoln were political rivals as young men and had gotten crossways. Lincoln had a lacerating wit, and he had offended Shields. Shields, they came up close to a duel, and Lincoln ultimately managed to joke his way out of it. Interestingly enough, in 1862, James Shields became a general in the Union Army, and Lincoln ran into him in May or June of that year, May, and somebody made a joke saying that the Shields is crazy, and Lincoln told a story about King George III, who was told that one of his generals was crazy. And George III said, yeah, but he fights. He said, if he is mad, I wish he'd bite my other generals. And this is a great example of Lincoln, you know, taking someone who had been an enemy and turning him into a useful cog in his effort to save the Union. This question of Lincoln and slavery is one of the most important and most perplexing because it's a very complicated matter. I strongly recommend Eric Foner's book that I mentioned earlier, which is the best ever written on this subject, The Fiery Trial. But in short, Lincoln was a man of his time, which meant several things. Number one, that the Constitution of the United States recognized slavery. And so as a lawyer who respected the Constitution, Lincoln did not feel that he had power to abolish slavery, mm-hmm. that it had to be done on a state-by-state basis. Number two, the Supreme Court, which had the power to enforce that Constitution, was the one branch of government in the 1860s that was in the hands, under the control of Southern sympathizers, starting with the Chief Justice, Roger Taney. Third, Lincoln didn't have a huge experience with mixed-race society because he came from a state where, in Illinois, free blacks were not allowed to settle there legally. So he knew very few. And he was a great disciple of the Kentucky Senator Henry Clay. Clay was his political ideal, and Clay was he was an anti-slave man who believed that the two races could not live together, and therefore he pushed an idea called colonization, which you can describe as back to Africa, but many of the colonization plans involved Central America or the Caribbean islands. So that's what Lincoln arrived with when he came into office. The process by which he worked through that to the Emancipation Proclamation is detailed in my book. His personal view of slavery, though, he summed up very simply. He said, I cannot remember a time in my life when I didn't feel that slavery was a grave moral wrong. And if I could end it, I would. Ultimately, he did.
Back to some phone calls here. Let's go to Joe from Kansas City, Missouri. Joe, you're on the air with David Vondrele. Good morning.
Good morning. Very good show. I was wondering what were some of the reasons why Abraham Lincoln chose two members of his cabinet to be from Missouri?
Good question. Because it was such an important state. Edward Bates, the attorney general, was the leading Republican in the state of Missouri when he was appointed to the cabinet. Second, I think you're referring to probably Montgomery Blair, the Postmaster General, in that first cabinet. The Blair family was extremely prominent in both Maryland and Missouri, which were two of the four, you know, slave-owning border states. They were the most important conservative Republican family in the country, and there was no question but that they had to be included in a union coalition government. And so those were really two layups. But they do point to the absolute importance of Missouri to the union effort, really all through the war. You know, the whole Western front of the war, the role of Kansas in bringing the war on.
Yeah.
All these stories are tend to be neglected by historians who tell the story of the war through the battles in Virginia and Maryland and Pennsylvania.
David, how did your opinion of Lincoln change as you worked on this book?
When I started the book, I really didn't believe that that one man held the Union together. And at the end of living through this year, day by day, as hour by hour, I came away convinced that if Abraham Lincoln had not been the president of the United States, there was no one else with the unique blend of vision, political skill, personal security, physical endurance, patience, craftiness, cunning, to do what was necessary. I think if he had not been there, there wouldn't be a United States.
Well, David von Braley's new book is Rise to Greatness, Abraham Lincoln and America's Most Perilous Year. I've already sent a copy to my dad, and David, I sure enjoyed having you. Congratulations on just a terrific book.
Thank you so much, Steve.
We'll see you back in town here.
All right.
More information about our guests and our program at kcur.org. Don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook and this program on Twitter. We're at KCUR up to date. Tomorrow on the program, we'll explore how editorial cartoons have affected a long line of presidents, particularly Teddy Roosevelt, and Brian McTavish returns with our weekend to-do list. The show is produced by Steven Steigman, Danny Alexander, and Beth Lipoff. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you are up to date.